if you don't mind sticking.
This is Tractor Tuesday Live, hosted by sixth generation Nebraska farmer and Tractor Tuesday founder Zach Bosley and Scott Anderson, owner of New Age Ag Supply. Join them each week as they sit down with farmers, innovators, dealers, and creators who are enhancing the culture within agriculture, right here on Tractor Tuesday Live.
Hey, Zach Bosley, we're live here, Tractor Tuesday Live, and if you haven't done this yet, everybody please like, subscribe, do all the stuff, because we never know when we're going to go live again or next, and make sure you sign up for notifications. With me, as usual, Scott Anderson, New Age Ag Supply, and today I'm really excited. I know Scott, as a devout carnivore, is as well. We've got Dr. Sean Baker on the program. Sean, how you doing today, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. Hey, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. And first of all, thank you guys for feeding people. I mean, that is such a, you know, thankless task. I mean, every time I get in, you know, on a show or event with, you know, people that produce food, I'm like, thank you guys for doing, which is hard. It's hard work and all of us benefit from that. So, you know, you guys don't get enough credit. So thanks for doing that.
Well, no, thank you. We really appreciate it. And, you know, I was telling, you know, Scott and a few of the other guys, I was kind of a carnivore hipster. You know, I did it before really this whole movement took off, and it was really because of what you were promoting at the time, Sean. And, you know, a lot of folks in ag, especially the cow-calf guys, they look at what your impact has been for them, you know, and the price of beef and everything else. You know, you've done more than any checkoff dollars ever done for the cow-calf and the feeders out there. So, you know, there's a lot of thanks to you to bring a little bit of attention on, you know, what some might consider an extreme elimination diet. But I think that it works for so many folks out there. It's just, it's refreshing to hear it from a medical doctor. And if I'm not mistaken, your background is more so as an orthopedic surgeon.
My formal training is in orthopedics. I spent, you know, about 2 decades putting people back together, you know, replacing hips and knees and broken bones and sports surgery. And I did a little bit of trauma surgery over in Afghanistan. And so, yeah, I mean, I've been pretty enmeshed in the sort of the typical medical world. And, I mean, I appreciate the nod for, you know, I think a lot of people have impacted the price of beef. You know, some of it has to do with scarcity, obviously with the droughts and stuff. And that has something I had nothing to do with. Don't blame me for that. But.
Well, and in my opinion, it's still too cheap. So, you know, I think half my audience, I think a majority of the folks paying attention, they're all in food production.
Right.
I think we're all more willing to pay a premium for what we know is true and local and, you know, better quality. And I think that's,
well, I mean, if, you know, if you look at the percentage of household income, what food used to be versus what it is now, I think, you know, maybe 1920s, 30s, you're paying 30% of your income's going to food costs. And now it's like 6 to 8% or something like that. So food has gone down and we've had cheaper food. And I think our health has suffered because of that. And, you know, it's one of those things where if we prioritize our nutrition, which we should, I think we'd have better quality of life. Absolutely. But, you know, as you guys, I don't know where you want to take the show, but I'll just mention, you know, the new dietary guidelines have just come out. And some of you guys, I'm sure, are aware of that. And there's been a greater emphasis on particularly, you know, whole food animal products like red meat, milk, eggs, and so on and so forth, which, you know, heretofore have been, you know, particularly red meat has been demonized pretty hard by the nutrition academic institutions, and some of the guidelines have reflected that in many ways. And so we're seeing a welcome change in that regard. And I do think in large part due to efforts of people that have gone on carnivore diets and proving that, hey, red meat is not killing everybody. It's actually in many ways helping people. And I know that, you know, Robert F. Kennedy himself admits to being on a carnivore diet, you know, or mostly a carnivore diet. So he's obviously been influenced by that. And since he wrote the first page, you know, he signed the first page, he and Brooke Rollins, Secretary Rollins, stating that, hey, red meat's back on the menu and eat more of it. And the fact that the new food guideline is an inverted pyramid is, that's very much an intentional symbolic gesture. It wasn't accidental that they chose an upside down pyramid as their image. And also the fact that the first item you come to when you read, you know, top left, like left to right, top to bottom, the first thing you come to is a hunk of red meat, and it's not just any, it's a ribeye steak, which is also very intentional. So, I mean, there's some very strong signals coming out of there, you know, from what the consumer is expected to take from this. And, I think that, you know, over the last couple of years, as you guys are probably aware, beef demand is actually up, you know, for the first time in 30 or 40 years, it's actually trending up. You know, it peaked in 1977 or something like that. We're eating 92 pounds a year per capita, and we dropped down into the low 50s, and now we're starting to inch back up there. And I think that in part that has to do with the advocacy of carnivore diets and people discovering that when they eat a bunch of meat, their health gets better. And so I think we're going to see more and more of that. So my hope is that we will, you know, put more cows on the ground and generate more healthy nutrition, you know, whether from meat or milk. I mean, that's cool. And, you know, and again, I think the push towards whole unprocessed food, I think, is important as well, because a lot of the commodity crops get stuffed into garbage. You know, that's unfortunate.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Yep.
That's really a lot of it, you know, and Scott's got quite the herd himself, and he sends them down basically just to pasture this year, right in my backyard. So in Nebraska. So we're trying to take care of his cows while we can, but there's just so many changes. And I think it's a little bit refreshing just to see so many more folks interested in trying to get their health back in check. And there's so many different ways to do it. And it's nice to see, you know, what you're putting out there, but Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, Sean, I just completed 1 year on strict carnivore diet. I am eating cheese, a lot of eggs, because I've got 500 layers on the farm. So that's my cheapest source of protein. And when it comes down to cost, like if you go to the store and you buy $25 a pound filet and you eat that three times a day, your food costs are going to be high. But if you go to the store and you start drinking eggs or eating omelets or, you know, the lower quality beef mixed in with some eggs, like steak and eggs, you can easily eat for way less than what you would think on a carnivore diet.
Oh,
the
for
cheeses,
sure.
Yeah, like my diet consists of, I drink two egg shakes a day, and I take 10 raw eggs, mix it in a shake, a little cinnamon in there, a little bit of protein powder just for flavor with like the no sugar protein powder and some milk. And I'll drink two of those a day, steak and cheese for lunch, and then steak and cheese for dinner. And that's about it. I quit drinking coffee. I haven't drank alcohol in 4.5 years. And over the course of this year, my body composition went from, I mean, I wasn't ever high. I've always been athletic and exercise every day, went from about 14 to 8. So extremely lean. Yeah. And I can eat a crazy amount of meat, stand up with my shirt off, and still have abs, you know, like where before you want to put a shirt on halfway through the meal because you're stuffing yourself with all this bloating bread product and everything else. But
it's always nice to see people that have experience, because I can talk all day long and you know, people always think I'm crazy. And then, you know, then somebody stands up and said, "Hey, I did it." And what he said is exactly true. So I remember I was at a Cattlemen's Association conference in California a few years back, and I was presenting, you know, kind of telling basically the same old story that I'm always telling people. And the president of the organization stood up and said, "Yeah, I was a diabetic, and when carnivore is gone." And this is, I think the NCBA president was there, CEO at the time was there. I forget his name now, but I literally said, look, you guys need to be running with this stuff, and you guys need to be, doing some studies on this, because even if, you know, you get, a tenth of a percent of the diabetics and the people with autoimmune disease to go carnivore for a while, most of the people that go carnivore, even if they don't stay carnivore a lifetime, they will end up eating a lot of beef for the rest of their life. They will become huge consumers of beef. And I think that is when it comes to demand and the Chekhov organization's supposed reason for existing is to market beef and to increase demand, I assume. This is one really good way to do it is tell people that eating carnivore is not bad for you.
Yes. I just had brunch with a friend of mine who's 85 years old. He said he just passed his first kidney stone at 85. And he told me that the doctor said, you got to eat less red meat. And so that whole, the kidney stone, like if we can talk about that for a moment, I've had a lot of people ask me to ask you about if there's any sort of correlation between carnivore and kidney stones, or if the kidney stones are more along the lines of, you know, coming from oscillates like vegetables. Mm-hmm. Where the science is.
Well, yeah, yeah. So what you point out correctly is calcium oxalate is present in the main component of about 80% of all kidney stones that are ever produced. So 80% of the time, it has nothing to do with protein or anything like that, or red meat. A small percentage of the time, you can get these calcium urate stones, which might have a relationship there. But generally, again, kidney stones, just like gout or any of the other lithic diseases, the underpinning problem is almost always metabolic disease. That is to say, obesity, prediabetes, hypertension, you know, all these things that run when our metabolism and our metabolic health is compromised. And so whether you eat red meat or not is really not a really important variable here. You know, and like I said, as you know, in your particular case, you know, the red meat, what did it do to you? It made you leaner. It made you probably metabolically more fit. So for the vast majority of the people, it's not to say that I've never seen somebody on a carnivore diet get a kidney stone, but I think the rates are probably lower than the general population. And generally those people are still recovering from their metabolic illness. And it does, you know, it doesn't reverse overnight. It might take you months to years to fully reverse decades of damage. And so, no, I don't think that eating red meat increases the likelihood of kidney stones. You know, unless, of course, you are eating a bunch of garbage and you're metabolically unhealthy and you keep doing that. But a carnivore diet is not that. That's very different. This is the thing. We often conflate a standard junk food American diet that has, you know, the McDonald's diet to, you know, because it has red meat and we think the red meat is bad. And it's not the case. Uh-huh. It's the combination of all those things, I think, that's driving the issues.
So yeah. Are you strictly meat, Sean, or are you doing some eggs? Are you doing fish? And yeah, if you're not doing
well, fish, I mean, you know, like I said, I've been doing it for 10 years, right? So I have gone through phases where I will consume only meat. I've done that for probably aggregate total of 3 or 4 years, where I've just only eaten red meat in total. Probably 90% of my diet comes from red meat, but I do, you know, I will have some eggs, I will have some fish from time to time, I will have some pork from time to time. I do have dairy, you know, occasionally. It kind of fluctuates sometimes, and I know for me, too much dairy is a net negative. So I have to just kind of, you know, use it in moderation, I suppose. And every once in a great while, I'll have something that's not carnivore at all. I mean, and I'm not, like I said, I'm not religious about it, but my baseline diet for me, like today I had a two and a quarter pound T-bone steak I had for a breakfast this morning. And that will be most of my calories today. I'll probably have something smaller this evening, because I tend to like to eat bigger meals earlier in the day, just because I think it produces better sleep than if I eat big meals at night. So, but yeah, I mean, 90% of my diet is red meat, and has been for now, you know, going on almost 10 years.
Yeah. So was your body composition before you really dove into carnivore much different? Because to me, it's really interesting. I'm 6'6", and I was always excited when I saw some of the performance that you were doing in these master divisions. It's like, man, Sean's a big dude. You know, and I mean, I think you're 6'5", something maybe.
Yeah, 6'5". I think I woke up this morning, I was 253. So I'm, you know, pretty sizable guy. I'm pretty, you know, got a decent amount of muscle on me. I mean, you know, be clear. I mean, I've lifted weights since I've been a 13-year-old kid. I've never stopped. I mean, I've not even taken a week off in 46 years. And so, and I just turned 59. But I mean, yeah, I mean, when I was on a ketogenic diet before, when I went carnivore, I leaned up a bit, you know. But honestly, you know, I can sort of gain weight, gain body fat, get leaner within the spectrum of carnivore. It's not this, you know, just by eating meat, you're automatically going to be lean. You can gain weight, you can gain body fat, and you can get lean. And it's often easier to do than say some of these other dietary strategies. But I've been anywhere from all the way down to 205. I got down to 205 in 2020, and I looked like a cancer patient. I was doing a very, very high fat, lower protein carnivore diet. You know, playing with, you know, minimizing, you know, just learning some stuff about how this diet works. And that was a personal experiment. So I got all the way down to 205. Wow. I was incredibly lean. I was probably, you know, 8% body fat, something like that. Certainly sub 10. But I just didn't like being that skinny. The last time I was that size, I was, you know, freshman in college or something like that. And I was like, that, this is not who I can, I can't handle that. So then I just blew right back up to 260 over about 3 or 4 months. I just ate like a, you know, maniac, and spent my early, I spent like, I think when I turned 55, I remember 54, I was 53 and I got really skinny. So 54, 55, I focused on putting on size and I just lifted, got real strong, got, you know, very, very strong, strongest I'd been in probably almost 20 years. And then over the last couple of years, and particularly this last 2 years, I've really focused on, you know, more trying to become more athletic. And so sprinting, jumping, you know, that type of stuff. So
did your, you know, top end speed, did that go down with the additional mass, or how was the,
well, it depends where you're talking. On the rowing machine, no, because I've set multiple world records on concept two on the rowing machine, because you're not penalized for weight. You know, the physics of that allow, it's actually the bigger you are, the stronger you are. Also, you have to be cardiovascular fit, of course, but I mean, then you can go to town on that. And so the best guys on that particular piece of machinery, are like 6'10" and big boys, you know, 6'10", yeah, you know, 260, yeah, or something like that.
It's a big pull.
So it's a big, big, long pull. So now as I'm focusing on sprinting, you know, on a track, the weight is a penalty. You know, it's obviously, yeah, there's no Olympic gold medalists that are 250. You know, they're all, you know, Noah Lyles is, you know, 175 or something, yeah, like that, 5'10". Right. So, yeah, so I've got my goal over this year is get from about 255 probably down to about 235. So I'm going to slowly just, you know, and the goal is to not lose strength and mass, you know, or muscularity. So I'll be very, very lean at 235, and hopefully my performance will be what I hope it can be, which I think it will be.
Here, we got an interesting question, and this always comes up, so I just wanted to address it. But it was, you know, talking about the impact of, you know, a carnivore diet on cholesterol. And I know it's a slippery slope, because they have a good, and then what they want to say, a bad cholesterol. And I've always balked at that. I just thought, you know, it's like just reading, you know, the pressure of an engine. You know, you're going to have these values. And I think they do such a great job of demonizing, you know, certain traits and characteristics. But just want to get your thought about the C word there of cholesterol.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a very important topic. I don't think people should ignore cholesterol. I know there's people out there say cholesterol has nothing to do with heart disease, and that if you're on a low carb diet, it's irrelevant. I think there's a lot of nuance around that. And certainly for a lot of people, particularly people that start out overweight, their cholesterol actually goes down. You know, their cholesterol will go down with a low carb ketogenic or carnivore diet. A really nice paper, a meta-analysis that was put out at the beginning of 2025 by a guy named Adrian Sotomoda, who's a PhD from Oxford. He's got an MD as well. He's a person I know reasonably well. Looked at 41 randomized controlled trials looking at cholesterol and low-carb diets, and they found that the biggest criteria for high cholesterol was how lean the person got. So the leaner people tend to have higher cholesterol. Now, the question becomes, in that particular situation, is it problematic? Does it lead to increased risk of cardiovascular disease? And that is very controversial. I mean, there is emerging evidence, and you know, I don't want to say it's conclusive evidence, but there is emerging evidence, because the first time people have looked at that show that those people that are otherwise metabolically healthy, not diabetic, not hypertensive, not inflamed, not obese, you know, low triglycerides, you know, the whole you know, gamut of good metabolic markers, and the only variable that's elevated is LDL cholesterol or total cholesterol or ApoB, and sometimes it can be dramatically elevated. It seems that a large percentage of those people are at no additional risk for cardiovascular disease. In fact, they may have less risk for cardiovascular disease than someone with lower cholesterol that is, you know, maybe not as metabolically healthy or even as metabolically healthy. So that data is still emerging. So I tell people in that situation, you know, first of all, the diet has to provide a benefit. You know, if you're doing a carnivore diet and you get no benefit from it and your cholesterol goes up, then it may not be worth the potential risk that might be there. But like in Scott's case and many other people's case, you know, I got leaner, I feel better. I assume he feels better. Life is better. Quality of life is better. I'm less inflamed. I can do more. Then you have a clear benefit there. And then the question is, how much risk do I have? And I think you can kind of sort of, you know, as of 2026, you can get some imaging. You know, a lot of people are proponents of what's called a coronary artery calcium scan. It's a quick, you know, kind of an X-ray of your chest. It's really, you know, CT scan of your chest, and they look for calcium. And that can be very predictive, you know, depending on your age. You know, if you're over 40, it makes sense. If you're over 40 and you get a zero score, that's generally reassuring. There, you know, there's can be exceptions to that. It's, again, there's a lot of nuance around this, but cholesterol is something that we have been studying since the early part of the 20th century. So over 100 years, and we're still debating the relevance of it, you know, in certain camps. And it's one of those things where, because there is a lot of contradictory evidence, even though the people that are adamant that, you know, it's all about how high your cholesterol is and how long it is, that may be true in the general population. But again, when you start to separate out groups, you know, it's like, what is, you know, true and accurate for one subset of the population may not actually be the same in this group. And so we're still learning about that stuff. So I would say pay attention, stay tuned. If you want to do a carnivore diet and you get a clear benefit from it, that's great. I would encourage you to do so. If the cholesterol goes up, I think that's a red flag to just at least get more information. You know, don't ignore it. You know, maybe get some imaging and then go with that. This, and I'll just, again, I'll put a plug for our company, Rivero.
Yeah.
We are a digital health company. We're licensed in all 50 states. Our physicians that deal with our patients understand this stuff and can kind of understand the nuance and work around those issues, because it's a real legitimate thing that we do see. I see a lot of people that, I mean, personally myself, my cholesterol didn't really change that much. You know, it's always been kind of a little bit high, and it's still a little bit high. I haven't gotten super, super lean and tested. You know, maybe if I get down and get really, really shredded, it'll go up a little bit higher. I suspect it will, just because I understand the physiology behind it, why it does that. But yeah, it's an issue. It's an issue. And I think it's, you know, the answer is not black and white. It's nuanced. And I think it's one of those things where we don't just, you know, I mean, because some people will say, oh, my cholesterol went up, carnivore didn't work for me. And I'm like, mm-hmm. What do you mean it didn't work for you? Did you feel? Yeah, I mean, everything else went better, but I couldn't tolerate because of the cholesterol. I think that might be a disservice to a lot of people. You know, it means.
Yeah, I never even heard of a CAC score until, again, you know, I saw you post one of your results and it was basically 0 or 1 or whatever the score was. You were at the bottom range. And I thought, well, that if that's more indicative of heart health, you know, this is really interesting. And it was new to me.
Well, I mean, you know, the other thing is, you know, I do a cardiac stress test about every day of my damn life, you know, I mean, right. Running sprints and all the rowing and all that stuff. So I've got a pretty good idea that my cardiac function is pretty good. And let me just say this. I mean, even though I am a huge, probably one of the world's largest proponents of this type of diet and the fact that nutrition matters, just as equally, so does sleep, so does exercise, you know, so does, you know, activity level, so does mitigation of stress, and so does, believe it or not, sunlight. I mean, sunlight is a pretty powerful stimulant or sort of determinant of health. Mm-hmm. So those are things I like to, you know, kind of talk about outside of just nutrition.
What about vitamin C? I've had quite a few people say, if you're eating only meat, unless you're eating like liver, you're not getting any vitamin C. And like, I haven't noticed anything. My mental acuity is like, I can remember stuff way better now, like a year after carnivore, than I could before. Like it's insane. My mental sharpness, I can rest. Like I track my sleep every night. It's like 100% or 98% every night. And it's never been that way.
Well, I'm not sure how directly vitamin C impacts sleep. I'm sure it has some effect on there, but as far as, and mental acuity, but as far as, you know, you clearly are not going to get as much vitamin C on a strictly carnivore diet as you could on a diet that includes, you know, fresh fruits, vegetables, and things like that. Red meat is, despite what the USDA says, is not devoid, even just a plain old, like, ground beef or hamburger, ribeye steak, whatever it is, still has a small amount of vitamin C in it. It's like something like 10 milligrams per pound of meat or something like that. So it's not very much, but it's considered to be enough to prevent scurvy. And I've not seen anybody legitimately with scurvy on a carnivore diet. There's a lot of physiology that would indicate that, you know, why this might be. We've known for about 150 years that red meat, you know, fresh red meat was curative for scurvy. So, you know, these Arctic explorers, when they got access to red meat, their scurvy would be cured. I mean, we've seen that, or it would prevent it. The problem is, you know, you have this, the so-called Limeys, you know, the British sailors from the, you know, 1700s were developing scurvy on these long voyages. And the problem with that is they were consuming dry meat, you know, salted meat, and it had a lot of carbohydrate in their diet, you know, this so-called hardtack. And that situation, yes, scurvy is present, but if you can have access to fresh meat, and it doesn't mean like freshly killed off the animal, it's just not been, you know, preserved or potted or salt, you know, preserved for a long period of time. it staves off scurvy. I mean, there are a lot of mechanisms by which that may be potentially the case. We know, for instance, that the glucose molecule and the vitamin C molecule are almost identical, and they share the same transporters, so they compete with each other. So when glucose is very high, vitamin C absorption is decreased. We also know that, for instance, carnitine, which vitamin C participates in its metabolism and function, is supplied in spades by meat. You know, when you consume meat, it's high in carnitine, and carnitine has its own gut transporters, and it's absorbed into the body, and so our carnitine levels tend to be high when we consume a lot of red meat. So then vitamin C requirements are lower. Vitamin C is an antioxidant. But when we go on low-carb diets, our endogenous antioxidants are elevated. So our vitamin C requirements go down significantly when we stop eating carbohydrates, or at least that appears to be the case. And there are certainly mechanisms which would support that assumption. I mean, the reality is no one gets vitamins. No one gets scurvy. And I know there's people say, well, maybe you have this subclinical deficiency that's going to show up. You know, I don't know when, 10 years I've been doing it. I'm waiting, still waiting. So it's just like, you know, it's really not an issue in my mind.
Yeah, sure. That's interesting.
What about fiber and constipation? Because I've noticed, you know, I've had, if I get too much cheese in my diet, things can get backed up.
Yeah.
But if I'm more heavy on the meat, like it's a lot smoother that way.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, and that's a real phenomenon. I think cheese can be constipating for a number of reasons. One, I think the calcium component in there, we know like a lot of, if you look at a lot of, if people that consume a lot of antacids, you know, like Tums and stuff like that, or Rolaids, they will often have issues with constipation. Anybody that's done that will know that. And one of the reasons is because of high calcium content. So obviously dairy has a lot of calcium in there. And then also there's these compounds called casomorphones, which are, they have like opioid-like effects on our physiology, including our gut. And what do opioids do to the gut? Anybody that's been on pain pills for a long period of time know that it can be very constipating. So I think those combinations with regard to cheese, so if you eat a lot of cheese, same thing happens to me when I eat a ton of cheese, which I don't do that often, but every once in a while, you know, you go hog wild on the cheese and then you're constipated. But the issue with the fiber, you know, because we hear that fiber is essential. And even though it's, you know, that, you know, they say, well, you know, males should be consuming around 30 grams a day and females 21 or something like that. The reason, and there are clear associations between a higher fiber diet, and positive outcomes, longevity, decreased various different diseases and something like that. But it's not the fact that you have this indigestible, basically wood pulp sitting in your gut that's causing you to live longer or have better health. That's not the fact itself. It's what it does to the body. And so what can it do? Well, it can cause a decrease in glycemic excursion. So if you're eating, you know, a sugary food, let's just use the example, an apple versus apple juice. But apple juice has all the fiber removed and our blood glucose goes up very rapidly after drinking apple juice. If we eat an apple, that response is blunted because of the fiber. So what else could you do to limit your blood glucose response? Well, you could, you know, eat a carnivore diet where there's no carbs. That also does a pretty good job of that. The other thing, and there, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things I can go in here. One of the things we know about a high fiber diet in the context of a Western developed world diet, you know, in the third world, people are eating fiber because that's all they can afford. I mean, they're forced into a plant-based diet out of necessity. Almost, you know, they're lucky if they can get an egg, you know, or maybe they get a little bit of milk. But but in the Western context, higher fiber diets are associated with affluence. You know, people that are wealthy buy fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains, and you know, they're conscious about their health. Whereas the poor folks tend to eat a lot of the processed stuff, you know, the cheap stuff that they can get, the cereals, the potato chips, you know. Buy one bag, get the
ramen noodles.
And that clearly is associated with lower out, you know, poorer health outcomes. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing, and this is a big thing that people talk about now, is just the so-called the microbiome. You know, the bacteria that live within our body, you know, and particularly in the gut, are dependent upon fiber to produce something called short chain fatty acids, and those short chain fatty acids in turn nourish the gut cells themselves, so that they're able to produce this protective mucosal layer. Well, we know that those short chain fatty acids can be obtained a number of other ways. For one, protein metabolism, protein fermentation, which is called putrefaction. So it's got kind of a yucky name, but I mean, it's the same thing. Bacterial action upon protein produces these short chain fatty acids as well, as does being in ketosis. We know that, you know, that one of the major ketone bodies in the bloodstream is something called beta hydroxybutyric acid. And there is butyric acid, which is the short chain fatty acid that fiber produces. So they sound very similar because they are. They're basically one hydroxyl molecule away, a little OH molecule, oxygen hydrogen molecule, and that easily is removed. And it's a very easily, you know, they can go back and forth between the other. So if you're on a ketogenic diet and you got like ketone floating around, and your colon cells have a blood supply, you know, the blood vessels get to all those cells, so they're being nourished the same way. So it's not necessary. It's not required. If you're on an omnivorous mixed diet, yes, conditionally it's beneficial. But if you want to opt for a no-carb sort of carnivore diet, the same effects are going to be achieved in many cases, better outcomes. And a lot of people, and I will tell you this, that particularly people suffering from gut issues, whether it be gastroesophageal reflux disease, so-called GERD, or constipation, diarrhea, IBS, IBD, which would be Crohn's disease, also colitis, those people, when they go carnivore and they eliminate fiber, almost without exception, will say, my gut health feels so much better. I'm no longer bloating. I'm no longer having these issues. And it's hard to argue that is meaning, you know, your health is worse because your gut feels better. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And it's kind of this common sense stuff. It's like, hey, you know, I shouldn't need my gut to hurt for me to be healthy. I shouldn't, you know, in order for me to have low cholesterol and I feel like garbage so I can live longer, doesn't make sense either, right? So there's these just sort of common basic principles, which I think are just, you know, my dog could figure that stuff out.
Yeah, yeah. Now, here's another question popped up here regarding blood types. You know, do you see anything? I know there was a book I had a buddy that was really into, and, should try X, Y, or Z, Zach, your own negative. And what do you think about the blood type?
Well, I mean, you know, and again, I kind of laugh at the blood type diet. I jokingly say if you've got red blood, then you should be able to eat red meat. If you've got green blood, then you can go vegan. I mean, if you're a Vulcan or something like that. But I mean, the reality is, and I've asked this question because I've been in contact with thousands and thousands of people doing carnivore diets, and every once in a while we'll do a little poll. Hey, what is your blood type? And almost without exception, we get, you know, a whole bunch of A's and B's and A B and A, you know, O negatives and O positive, very much in the distribution of the normal general population. So it doesn't seem to impact whether you can get success on a carnivore diet. Mm-hmm. Now, potentially, you might have some variation, and you know, we see population specific tolerances to things like dairy products. We know that large swaths of the world, depending on what their, you know, ethnic background is, may or may not be able to tolerate dairy because they're lactose deficient. You know, we see people with greater or less sensitivity to gluten and wheat and stuff like that. So I think it makes sense for certain types of food, which are, I think, kind of novel food that were added to the human diet at a much later stage. I think meat is a very ancient food. I think it's one of the first foods. And I think in many ways, it's what made us human beings. You know, if you want to go down the evolutionary rabbit hole, and I know some people think that's nonsense, but but the short answer is I think the blood type diet when it comes to carnivore diet is irrelevant.
Yeah. No, you know what I've noticed is, you know, once we transition our children off of breast milk, you know, the first thing we do is we try to get either raw goat or cow's milk. And then, you know, I hate to even talk about me being such a slob with YouTube guys on the show, but I'm either all in or I'm all out. And that's my biggest problem. So I can be the most disciplined guy in the world for a season, and if I feel like I'm going to let a coach down, I'm on it, you know. But then I get in the off season of life, and next thing you know, I'm eating cereal and I'm doing all these crazy things. But what I noticed was I could be, you know, maybe labeled as lactose intolerant if I'm going store-bought. Now, when we get this raw milk from a wonderful dairy here local in Hastings, I you don't notice those issues. And I don't know if the enzymes are different, what's really going on there, but
some of the enzymes are still active. I mean, that's pretty clear. I mean, the pasteurization process does break down some of these proteins that would act that way. Mm-hmm. I was just in Florida last week, and it's kind of funny. I went to a restaurant. It was actually a grocery store that had a restaurant inside of it, and also I had like a couple bars. So it was a really kind of a festive atmosphere. It's kind of a place called Seed to Table in Naples, Florida. And, they have a deal where, you pick your steak out at the, you pick it at the grocery store and they'll say, hey, you want us to cook it up for you and you can eat it in a restaurant. And yeah. So we do that. And then we had a gallon of raw milk. Cause I was there with the owner of the grocery store. Yeah. And, we had a big gallon of raw milk. We were drinking out of wine glasses and, it was fun. It was nice. And yeah, I mean, I think that, obviously there's a sort of a movement to support raw milk. You see people talking about that and saying that the issues with dairy are solely due to the fact that it's pasteurized. I'm not convinced that's the case. However, I think for the most part, raw milk is probably fine for most people. Yeah. I think that probably some of the issues that were historically around that had to do with sanitation and, mm-hmm. Maybe you had cows that had mastitis or workers that weren't using sterile technique, contaminating the milk and that's fine. So if that's taken care of and as it should be, and you should be, like I said, you should be inspected and make sure you're meeting, compliance standards, then I think raw milk is probably fine for most people. And it's a good source of nutrition. Milk, dairy, despite the fact that some people have intolerances to it, dairy in general is a wonderful source of nutrition. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's think about what the job is. It's to grow stuff, right? Say little things and make them big. Right. Humans, cows, whatever, dogs, chicken, mm-hmm. Well, not chickens, goats, camels, yeah. Whatever it might be. I think it's a great product for most people. Now, the problem I will say is that for people that are struggling with obesity, drinking your calories is generally a bad idea because it's so much rapidly, it's so easy to overconsume that. So that's the thing. Just realize that dairy is easy to overconsume.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it's just, one more thing. And yeah, I need to quit hanging out with guys like you and Scott. I didn't want to take my shirt off or go to the beach with these types of people. Jeez, I got to get it back in order here. But I think
there's there's a challenge for it. We're gonna hold you to it too. So yeah.
Well, and for better or worse, I was starting to go down this whole peptide, deep dive, and for me, I had a major fusion, and it was one of the times I reached out to you, Sean, back in the day, and I think I may have even sent you, either a screenshot of an MRI or potentially even the X-ray with the big concern. And half these quacks, I hate to use the Q word in front of you, but it was like a sales pitch and they said, we can go in there, just micro, disc, whatever it was called. And and then I finally met a neurosurgeon. He said, Zach, everybody, especially guys like you that play ball, he goes, you're all walking around with herniated discs. He goes, change this, do that. And I thought, okay, well, this guy gets it. And that's what I was waiting to hear. And then unfortunately, it was beyond my control. I had that vertebrae. Lost stability, completely broke. I had no control over my body at that point. I had to go under the knife. But, I was interested in, I think it's BPC-157. And they call this, there's another peptide, you can stack it. They call it like the Wolverine, whatever they call it, because it allegedly will help your body recover and, tissue and even all these things. But yeah, what are your thoughts there, Doc?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of marketing around that stuff. I think the actual clinical data that's been actually looked at rigorously is equivocal at best. I mean, again, I always use this analogy that regardless of your therapy that you want to do, whether it's PRP injections or prolotherapy or the various peptides or stem cell injections, I think, this is the analogy I have. If you got an old house and the carpets are all musty and nasty and you want to replace them, maybe put some hardwood floors on there, but at the same time, your house is on fire, it's probably not the best time to replace the floors. So, get metabolically healthy, lose all the excess weight, dial it in and then see what you need. And if this stuff is going to have some efficacy, sticking a bunch of thousands of dollars worth of supplements and injections and things like that into a body that is metabolically just out of control, it's just a waste of money, first of all. So that's the first thing I would say. Again, remember, there is a lot of money to be made in these things and people market. And like you said, it is a sales job in many ways. And you just have to be mindful of that. Even though I'm on this wacky carnivore thing and I've been promoting it, I'm pretty skeptical about most things because most things, the outcomes are maybe placebo effect, maybe they're non-existent, maybe they're overhyped. They generally are. And that's one thing you can rely on for, whether it's pharmaceutical companies who own most of the supplement companies, by the way, whatever they say, you can basically, like this thing will do, you can kind of cut it in half for the benefits, and whatever they say that the minimal side effects are, you can probably at least double those, and then you're kind of maybe closer to the truth on that. So okay. I'm not a big pro supplement peptide guy at this point. And I know there's people out there that swear by it. And you know, there's a lot of peer pressure. Oh, you know, this is a stack. You're going to get on Retta and you're going to be on BP-157 and all these other things. And you're going to become a real man then. And what's holding you back? What's holding you back, punk? You know,
See, I'm like the opposite. I think, you know, the guys that were the real men, they did it from 14 to 21. You know, and then you see these guys and they're all juiced out of their heads. And
you that's the thing. You get a lot of these guys that are they're basically just steroid salesmen. I mean, they get jacked up on a bunch of steroids and then they start talking about, I mean, it's a friggin' Muscle and Fitness cover from 1985. Same thing, you know, take all the drugs and then say this other product, which I happen to have a financial interest in, is what really got me there.
Right.
So I'm very skeptical of most of this stuff. And there are people that are very convincing. I mean, they got good marketing. They got good sciencey sounding technology. They'll berate the people that disagree with them. And like I said, it remains to be seen. I'm open minded, but I'm very skeptical of most things. So I think it's sleep, it's good nutrition, it's consistency in the gym, and a few other things that I've outlined. And if you do those things well, probably also those things are just superfluous and you don't need them.
If you follow the money, like even the clinical research is financed by pharmaceutical companies, and they have a positive outcome if certain things they hire the scientists. Like a lot of that stuff is masterfully kind of fixed to.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the research paper is basically marketing propaganda, is what it ultimately turns out to be. And you know, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pharma sponsored clinical trials, because they're expensive and no one else has the money to sponsor them. You know, like I said, I've been trying to get these nutrition studies done for years now. And finally, after, you know, yelling about it for 7 or 8 years, finally got a little bit of money together so we could do some of this stuff. But these things are, as Marcia Engel, the former New England Journal of Medicine chief editor said, I can no longer trust these journals. I mean, I can't trust any of this data anymore because it's been so manipulated. And the fact that, you know, a pharmaceutical company can conduct a randomized control trial or whatever it might be and submit their data and only submit their summary of the data. They don't even have to show the actual findings. You know, they don't show the raw data. They can keep that and call it proprietary, so we don't have to display that. So who knows if it's fabricated? Who knows what they left out? And a lot of times they'll leave out data that does not support the outcome they want, that leads to sales. And so we're in a time where, I mean, you know, as you guys know, with AI, you can't trust what you see anymore. You know, you can't trust what you can hear, can't trust what you read, can't even trust what you see. And so it's a tough time to try to make decisions. You know, it was easier when you had three public TV channels and that's all you had to think about, you know, PBS or was it CBS, NBC and ABC when I grew up, you know, in the 1970s, like, maybe.
Well, and it could be argued it was easier to get brainwashed too, you know, and then here.
Well,
we
I mean, it's true. But I mean, again, now we have a lot of conflicting opinions, which I think is hopeful. It's helpful because opening people's minds, but then it's very easy to get trapped in that. And it's very persuasive, particularly when you start seeing stuff that's manipulated that you have no idea it's been manipulated. And it's creatively edited so that it leaves out the context. So now you become radicalized. And I mean, and this is around a lot of things, not just nutrition. It's a tough time.
You know, with all that said, is there any other form of supplementation as far as, I mean, you get so much protein from the red meat, so I highly doubt you're kind of a whey or any sort of, you know, protein.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, I'll just comment. I mean, I think whey protein is a very good source of protein. It's probably one of the top ones. I mean, there's been new papers indicate that maybe casein's a little more effective, but I mean, certainly whey protein has stood the test of time for those that tolerate it. Again, I don't think we are designed inherently to be consuming powders. I mean, this is not something you find in nature. You don't go out and find powder on a tree, you know, or maybe some mold powder that would kill you. But so I mean, you know, whether it's flour or sugar or protein powder, we're not designed for that. However, you know, if we're going to do that, then yeah, whey protein is a very good source of protein. Yeah, I mean, eating, you know, 3 pounds of meat a day, I'm not hurting for protein. You know, I mean, I've got 300 grams of protein right there that I get easily. And I have no problem hitting protein goals for me. And again, I sort of maybe optimistically think that, you know, we should be able to get what we need as a human being from food. I know it sounds kind of crazy. We live in a time where, oh, you know, everybody wants to supplement this or that. And they think that, you know, and well, you guys as farmers, I mean, you know, they talk about the soils are depleted and, you know, all the stuff that's caused, you know, a decrease in the quality of the food. And maybe that some of that's true. How much it requires you to supplement, I don't know. Again, I'm this guy that eats a bunch of meat and seems to be doing pretty well and sees thousands of people doing the same. So I have no supplements to sell. Maybe if I were selling supplements, I'd have a different opinion on supplements, right? You know?
Yeah.
Well, no, farmers are pretty similar to doctors. I mean, we basically work for the same pharmaceutical companies. Like Dow Chemical owns most all the herbicides. They own Monsanto. I mean, and it's there's a revolution happening in farming right now where people are trying to figure out how to use less commercial fertilizer, less herbicides. People are seeing how the animal impact, like I was a straight up grain farmer, corn, soybeans for the last 20 years. And now 4 years ago, I bought cattle because I learned about the regenerative strategy you can do with cattle. Yeah. Otherwise, without animal impact on your row crops, you have to supplement with this commercial stuff, which kills all the good bacteria, mycorrhizal fungi, like all that stuff. I mean, there's a whole Joel Salatin and some of these guys you probably heard of. They have a lot of great topics about this. And I was at Joel Salatin's farm last summer talking about this stuff. And anyway, it's just interesting the control that 5 or 10 companies have on basically the entire food industry.
Yes. I mean, you know, like I said, there's a lot to do with it with our food system. And, you're correct. I've talked to almost everybody in the so-called regenerative ag world when it comes to animal agriculture, particularly cows, Joel Salatin, you know, Will Harris, Gabe Brown, I mean, Alan Savory. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've talked to, you know, 40 or 50 guys from that arena, and it's growing. It's a growing movement. I think that you're probably maybe seeing more support coming out of the U.S. government for a change. Maybe there's going to be some sort of incentives to do that, because, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, whether it's, you know, I know, like, whether you buy crop insurance or, you know, you have this different incentives to do certain things. And I think we're incentivizing in many ways the wrong things. I know a lot of people are critical of the sort of the ethanol program. It's like, is that a good use of the land? You know, should we just graze that land instead of producing this biofuel out of it? You know, again, I'm not an expert in that area, but I know these are issues that are talked about, and you guys probably have more insight to that than I do.
Yeah. And it's interesting. A lot of times, you know, a lot of this data is just cherry picked just for a headline or a title. And what's interesting about ethanol production, they never talk about the dry distillers grains. And so that's in theory,
in more cattle field.
Yeah, exactly. They won't talk about that. But, you know, if you want to talk about the electric car, they won't talk about the mining side of everything for the lithium and the logistics behind, you know, and so they can kind of cherry pick that just in the same way they do with a lot of this medical data that's out there. So I think the moral of all of these stories is, let's get healthy, you know, and it's a daily battle for me. And I'm envious of you two for just the discipline. And I've always lacked that. And I never had met Scott in person until probably maybe September. And I was like, holy cow, this guy's like a pro wrestler. You know, he's just jacked out of his mind. And I'm thinking, man, another one of these guys, you know, and it's embarrassing. I've got to get my stuff together.
Well, get after it, man.
Oh, I know. it's easy to make.
You got to make it happen. Don't make excuses. Don't accept your mind. Don't set, you know, have the mindset that I'm not going to fail no matter what. And that's what it takes. I tell this to my patients. I say, look, you know, you can live the rest of your life as a sick person, or you can decide today that you're no longer a sick person and you just make it happen. And you know, you know, like I said, if it's important enough to you, you'll make time rather than making excuses. And I think as you get older and older, and that mortality window is, you know, it's closing a little bit, you start to appreciate your health and what it takes to get there. And, you know, like I said, I didn't start this. I mean, I always was an exercise guy. I always worked out hard, train. I was always a pretty, pretty decent athlete, but it wasn't until my sort of early 40s where I started to realize that, hey, I gotta do something on the nutrition side too. Yeah. And I didn't switch this carnivore thing until I was almost 50. And so, Yeah, it's not too late, but you know, you get, starting earlier is, I wish I had started earlier. All I can say is that I wish I had started earlier.
So yeah. a lot of, for most people, if you had the discipline to do it, you'd already be doing it. And I think, I'm not sure what Rivero is, your company, but I believe that some of the stuff you do is help people get dialed in on their nutrition and stuff like
that. That's a good point, because a lot of people know what to do, you know, and a lot of people have done it sporadically over the years, but developing that sort of mindset that the discipline, because it is discipline. It's not, like I said, motivation is fleeting. I'm not often motivated to go work out in the gym. I'm not feeling particularly motivated today, but I'm going to go do it and I'm going to get after it when I get there, but I'm not motivated to do it. So I just built that into the day, and just kind of, you know, do it regardless. But yeah, I mean, at Rivero, we have a lot of people that, you know, that really need, they need motivation, they need accountability, they need support, they need question answering, they need different strategies, they need a supportive team. You know, one of the things I found, you know, talking about people that had success with their health, you know, with regard to diet in particular, is like, if you have support at home with your family, at work with your fellow employees or bosses, your friends, and just as importantly, if not more importantly, your physician, you are about 30% more likely to be successful. And those people that don't have that supportive environment around them are going to struggle. And so, you know, you can, again, these are things that you have control over in many cases. And so we have, like at Rivero, our physicians are very supportive of this stuff. And that's the whole point why we exist, is to get people that want to, you know, fix their lifestyle for the first time in their life or sustain it more or less. And I meet with those patients. I personally meet with all the patients a couple times a week, or I make myself available to them through, you know, large group meetings and, you know, kind of continue to sort of motivate these folks.
So are you still active on the orthopedic side? Or are you doing?
No, surgery? I don't do any more surgery. I stopped doing that about 10 years ago. It's not possible to dabble into that. I mean, realistically, it's just not good for anybody involved, the patients, for you as a surgeon. I think you got to be all in. I found that I have a lot more personal satisfaction in what I do now. I mean, surgery was fun. I enjoyed doing it. Obviously impacted a lot of people's lives in a positive way, you know, made their knee feel better with new knees or hips or whatever it might be. But it's the amount of transformative health I'm able to do now through this is orders of magnitude different. I mean, it's just so much more rewarding.
So do you mind stepping us through real quickly, just if someone's interested in Rivero, you know, what's the process? What does that look like for a potential?
Yeah. So if you go to Rivero.com, there's a phone number, you just give us a call and we will initiate the process. You meet with an enrollment advisor. They will determine if what you have is something we treat, because there are some things that are not amenable to digital care. You know, you can't treat broken bones over the internet, you know, as much as we'd like to, you can't do that yet. We don't quite have the Star Trek tools to scan some, you know, the tricorders or whatever they had. But I mean, we treat, you know, metabolic issues like obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, prediabetes, hypertension. We treat a whole host of autoimmune disease. We treat a bunch of inflammatory conditions. So if those things are part of your, you know, it doesn't have to be the only thing you have, but if you have one, if that's one of the things you're suffering from, then we can accept you, assuming you're not like on your deathbed or, you know, you got to have some level of ability to use an internet, you know, and that type of stuff. Then you will then be entered into the program. We will, you'll have access to our app. You'll then meet with you'll get labs ordered. You'll meet with your physician. The physician will design a plan for you. You'll meet with your coaching team. They will help you to optimize and initiate the plan. You'll have weekly check-ins, daily feedback that we'd like you to upload so that we can monitor your progress and then make adjustments on the fly. Very often our patients start just de-prescribing medicines within, you know, a couple of weeks. We're like, hey, you know, your blood pressure is normalized. Let's get you off these blood pressure pills, or your diabetes is getting better. Let's decrease these doses, and so on and so forth. And then most of the patients will stick around with us on average about 6 months. And by the 6 month point, most of them are kind of cured or you know, sufficiently healed that they don't need our support, ongoing support. So that's kind of the model. It's not a very good business model, in the fact that it's not the, you know, we've got you for the rest of your life. You just need to take big pills. That's what the pharmaceutical model is. You know, you know, you take these weight loss shots for the rest of your life, and at, you know, $1,000 a month or whatever it is, or whatever they negotiate, I'll negotiate the price down a little bit. But again, it's, I think it's the right way to do medicine. It's the ethical way to do medicine. And I'm very, you know, very proud to be associated with that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, it's great.
So can you guys write prescriptions? Like, let's say I'm a Rivero client and I've got a rosacea.
Yeah.
Can I send you pictures of the rosacea and you guys can write a prescription for ivermectin?
Well, we certainly can write prescriptions, and it, you know, it depends on, you know, the physicians are all licensed. They can do whatever a normal physician does. You know, we have protocols that we use for certain conditions. You know, it just depends on the physician there. I will say, you know, I don't know if you saw this recent study that came out on rosacea, for instance, that they saw that these little mite, you know, these little mites that live on your face are probably causing that. And so one of the hacks was just putting a little bit of petroleum jelly, a little Vaseline on the eyelids at night, do that for about a month. And it has shown to significantly kill those things that may be associated with that. So that might
just got hip to it with the ivermectin cream. I was like, I'll just use one of these, you know, online pharmacies or go to Tractor Supply.
Yeah, but our physicians do write prescriptions. But I mean, our main mission, the main thing we do is deprescribe, because most people don't need to be on medicine, right? So we're trying to get people off.
But it's just so common, Doc. You know, I'm 44 and I've got farmer friends that are my age and younger, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, I got high blood pressure, you know, and everybody's just so apt to just take a prescription instead of, you know, look in the mirror.
I mean, I get it that farming, I assume it's a busy, long hour lifestyle. I assume, maybe not, but I assume
it's seasonal. Just, it depends. And then, seasonal, you know, even your location, everything varies.
Yeah. So I say, you know, you can't always do what you need to do.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think most people can. I mean, irrespective. I mean, even when as a busy surgeon, you know, I mean, even in my training, when I was working 100 hours a week, I still made time to exercise. I mean, I was still, even if it was 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd go to the gym and get a workout in. So, I mean, it was one of those.
And that's the truth of it. If you really need to do it, you'll make the time, you know, regardless of what your schedule is. And we walked in, my oldest is 3 and a half. My daughter just turned 2 and we've been taking them to gymnastics. My wife said, "Hey, that's my quarter over there," and neighbor in the farm world. And I couldn't see the guy. I'm looking around for him and I knew he'd been on carnivore, and I finally figured out, oh, there's Chad right there. And God, I'm not trying to point him out in case he's watching, but man, he probably dropped about 60 pounds, you know, the past 6 months, and just looks like he's 10 years younger. And it's amazing when people can just stick to something simple. And I think that's a lot of the attraction of carnivore. It's just, you know, the whole keto and, you know, back when it was called low carb and everything else, there is a lot more detail to it. And I think that's what's attractive by carnivore. Is it's a great place to start, you know, find what your weaknesses are and at least eliminate a lot of the processed BS out of the diet.
Yeah, it's certainly educational. You learn about your body really, really, really well when you do things like a carnivore diet. And simplicity is nice because it's not hard. You know, if you're not calculating, and you know, if you, you know, you guys, you know, when you feed animals, you're not giving them a menu. They don't have like variety. I mean, eat the same crap every day. You know?
Yeah,
it's just like, it's like, you know, you don't have like, oh, what would you like today, pigos? You know, what would you like cows? What would you like, a little more alfalfa? Can I give you a nice fresh, you know, green salad? I mean, it's just. You know, I mean, I think feeding animals and humans or animals should be pretty simple, you know, and I said, you should be able to explain it to somebody in about 10 seconds, you know, and if
well, no disrespect to the medical doctors, but I mean, honestly, I can get a little bit more detail from a veterinarian than I can, you know, my family doctor here in town. And, you know, even with gestation, it's just my wife and me have our own math. You know, today is our official due date, according to the people at the doctor's office, but, you know, it still hasn't came yet, and kind of our math seems a little bit more accurate. And I think they've got the gestation period down with the inseminated heifers a little bit than do the humans.
I mean, it's a lot easier to do research on animals, right? I mean, you know, you control all the variables. I mean, you know exactly what they're eating, how much they're eating. And then, you know, you can kill them at the end. It's kind of open to see. Can't do that on human research. I mean, it's frowned upon when you kill your patients and, you know,
yeah, at least not in the U.S., you know, publicly.
Yeah, maybe in China, I guess, or, you know, I was in Washington, D.C. last week talking to a guy named Jan Jekulik, who's at the Epoch Times, and he's doing this big expose on organ harvesting in China. Apparently, he posits that there is something like 1 million people who have been executed to steal our organs to you know, give to rich people so they can live longer. So, anyway,
yeah. I got a few questions, but I don't want to take a lot of time. So I wonder if we could just do a quick rapid fire and you just give me like a quick answer on this.
Absolutely.
Parasites. Yeah. Are you concerned with high meat diet, parasites in your system? Do you do parasite cleanses?
So I guess I want to clarify the term high meat. So high meat, it can mean two different things. One, it means meat that's been sitting out, left to rot for a long period of time, and people consume high meat. They call that high meat because they kind of get high off of it, right? Yeah. Or you talk about eating a lot of meat. And if you're saying eating a lot of meat, I don't think, particularly like in the US or most developed countries, parasites are a real issue. I think it's overblown. I think if you're eating, you're going to India and eating some feral cow, yeah, probably it's an issue. Like when I was in Afghanistan as a trauma surgeon, every damn one of our patients was full of parasites. You know, you do an operation on it, and you know, you'd feed them various anti-helminths, and worms would just come flying out of their butt. I mean, it was these big worms, you cut in their intestines, they were full of worms. So yeah, I mean, parasites are there, but I don't think that in our system in the US it's a significant problem for most people.
Okay, gas station carnivore. You stop into a gas station, what are you going to eat? What are you going to pick off the shelf to stay carnivore? Gas
station carnivore. If they got a hamburger patty, I might have that.
Pork rinds?
Yeah, I mean, pork rinds are okay. I mean, yeah, pork rinds are okay. I mean, it's a snack. I mean, obviously, I don't really use gas station as my most common place to get food. Yeah, I mean, I'd have to look specifically. But yeah, I mean, again, if they have single item foods in there, you might get some like boiled eggs or something like that. You might be able to find that. You might be able to find some cheese sticks or something like that. Maybe a little bit of, you know, lunch meat or something like that. But again, I wouldn't make that the mainstay of my diet. I'd rather you go to McDonald's and just go grab a burger patty, you know, or Burger King, or I like Wendy's. I think Wendy's has a better burger from a national brand personally, but yeah.
Okay. Homemade kefir. Or however you pronounce it, kefir.
Kefir, kefir, whatever. Yeah.
Is that part? Is that good for you on a carnivore diet? Maybe from gut health standpoint.
Well, I mean, the thought is that fermented food in general, whether it be kimchi, sauerkraut, kefirs, yogurts, and things like that, are beneficial to the gut. I think what they are is they're less deleterious to the gut. And I think what's happening is when your gut is required to ferment food, you get all the sort of the waste products from the fermentation, the bloating, the gas, the methane, some of the other things that occur. And so when the food is pre-fermented, I think it's tolerated better. So I think on net, it's probably better to eat fermented dairy and fermented vegetables, if that's your thing, than to eat non-fermented ones.
Where did you get the machete you used to cut your steaks on your Instagram stuff?
So I've got a collection of knives. I don't remember why I initially bought one, because I think I was cutting some steaks up and it's just easier. And then I'm lazy. I'm like, well, I don't even want to clean the dish. I'll just eat directly off the cutting board, you know? And so that's how I started. And the first one I got was a little, what's called a bullnose knife from Costco. It was Chinese company called Kangshan Knives or something like that. And then subsequently, so a lot of people sent me knives, believe it or not. Like, hey, check out here, let me send you a knife. And I got some like a speak gifts for as when I've spoke at conferences, some people give me a knife as a reward. So, so I've got several knives, and honestly, it's weird not eating without them now. I mean, because, I go to a restaurant and they give you that little tiny fork, tiny knife. I feel like, when you have a really big sharp knife, it just, the meat cuts better. And, yeah. I eat pretty big pieces of meat. So, it works pretty well. And I'm a big guy too. I'm a big guy. These little knives, they feel like almost like kids' toys in my hands.
Right. Yeah. Well, no, that's great, Scott. Well, hey, Sean, we don't want to hold you down.
Smoked meat. Sorry. There might be a little lag here. It's smoked meat and, a dried meat, like beef jerky and stuff like that. What's your thoughts on that?
Sorry, I was chasing my dog down. She was trying to crawl all over the computer. I didn't want her to disconnect us. So, Yeah. I mean, well, dried meat. And I do that a lot at home. I've got a foodie. In fact, I just bought some to dry out today a few minutes ago. I think dried meat is fine. Particularly if you make it homemade, get yourself a food dehydrator, take some thinly sliced fatty meat, is probably better. Just throw a little salt on there and throw it in the food dehydrator. Wonderful snack. I use it. It's almost like, they eat almost like potato chips do. They're kind of addictive. You can overeat them. Smoked meats, we've been doing that for arguably thousands of years, you know, and maybe even hundreds of thousands of years, depending on what you believe. I think it's fine. I don't think it's a big issue. I think that, some people will point out these so-called N-nitroso compounds. And, you know, when we have like charred meat with the heterocyclic amines and polyaromatic hydrocarbons being problematic. The problem with that is we don't have good dose effect data that shows that, a higher dose shows greater rates of problems. We've been adapted to those things for arguably as long as we've been humans. You know, we've been cooking meat for a long, long time. If you believe an evolutionary model, that goes back to about 1.5 million years ago. I don't really have a problem. And I smoke meat all the time. I mean, I got a Traeger and I'm out there smoking. In fact, I'll be smoking up a tri-tip tonight. So I eat a fair bit of smoked meat. I don't think it's the biggest issue. There's people that would say that cooking meat is a problem and you should only eat raw meat. I don't think that's necessary. I think humans discovered fire and went with that for a reason. And we've been doing it for a really long time. If you believe that we should all be eating raw meat, then at least sear your steak, sear the steak on the outside and eat it rare, raw on the inside, and problem solved, I think, for most people.
Yeah, there you go.
Sure.
You got any more rapid ones, Scott? Yeah, well, no,
that's good for now.
Probably a good spot. Well, hey, Sean, do you mind plugging more of your socials again one more time for everybody out there watching?
Yeah, sure. So like I said, if you're a patient, you got some sort of health issue, you want help, check out revero.com. That's revero.com. And I interact with all the patients. So I'm there, a couple times a week, chatting with the patients. So I am on, various social media, on X rather. It used to be Twitter. It's S Baker MD. I think the S and the M, or the S and the B and the MD are capitalized. Instagram, I'm on Sean Baker 1967. So SHAWN and then Baker 1967.
Okay.
I'm on, let's see, what is the other one? Sean Baker MD, I think, is on my YouTube channel and my Facebook and my TikTok. And I think I might be on Spotify now too. And I think somebody wants to open a Threads thing for me as well for some reason. I don't really care.
Writing a lot of carnivores on Threads yet. So
I don't know. I've never even looked at it. I know it's kind of like the more sort of liberal leaning side of the social media curve and for whatever reason. And I don't really care, but there seems to be more people that tend to be a little bit more right leaning, more favorable to carnivore. I mean, I don't think it should be political. I think all humans, irrespective of your race, religion, creed, political belief, should be eating good quality food. I mean, that's essential. We should all, and the better our quality of nutrition is, the better our mental health is, and the less crazy we are.
Well said. Yeah. I think that's the big thing, guys. It's just, this is probably more so for myself. Just get serious, get after it, and put the excuses aside and just eat better quality, food. I don't care if you're a vegan, a carnivore, whatever it is, just get better quality food and skip the processed BS. We don't have time for it.
Yeah. I mean, don't eat like a kid. And you're not a kid. Yeah. Eat like a grown adult. And I think that solves a lot of the problems. So.
Yeah, no, that's great.
I just want to encourage everybody to follow Sean on social media, watch his Instagram posts. He's constantly talking about, you recently did one about kidney stones. I mean, you talk about diabetes and people who have went from 800 pounds to 250 pounds that you've met and through the carnivore diet. It's inspiring. You're going to learn a lot and you're going to be inspired if you follow Sean and watch his YouTube videos, his interviews with Joe Rogan. I mean, we just want to thank you for what you do, Sean. You're speaking the truth and we're just glad that you stepped up out of the darkness and into the light and are shedding some light on nutrition for people. I'm so grateful for that.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And we all got to share the message. And this sort of Make America Healthy Again movement is going to be grassroots. government ain't going to do it. Yeah. Who's in there? We got to do it ourselves. So anyway, thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, excellent. Well, for Sean Baker, Scott Anderson, I'm Zach Bosley, Tractor Tuesday. Again, make sure to like, subscribe, and get those notifications. I don't know when we're going live again. I think maybe our producer's got a clue, but just for that, we'll sign off now, and we'll catch you next time at Tractor Tuesday Live.